The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
So did you guys have the cupcakes with the stout icing? I think I'm drunk. I'm drunk on pastry. Embarrassing. Thank you all for coming tonight. I am so happy to be home in Philadelphia. It's great to be here. Yay! I was in New York last night. They didn't do a good job eating their cupcakes, so I know that my girls and boys here are going to do better and not send me home to a, you know, hotel room with several dozen cupcakes and bad things happened. So a couple weeks ago, I went to New York to tape the Rachel Ray Show. And yes, because this is what you do when you promote a book, you try to get yourself on TV. And I had my mom with me because I like to have my mom with me. You know, I'm 40, but, you know, girl needs her mom. So we pull into the garage, which is sort of under the studio, and ahead of us is like this giant armored Hummer with, like, you know, so we're watching like people get out and get onto an elevator, and then we get out and the security guard says, "Do you know who that was in that other car? That was Rosie O'Donnell." Okay, so my mother, as some of you may know, is a gay lesbian woman, okay? So telling her that Rosie O'Donnell is in the building is basically like telling a fundamentalist Christian that Jesus is hanging out in the green room, okay? So Fran elbows me out of the way, goes dashing up the steps of the show, and she's like, "I have to meet her. I have to meet her. I have to meet Rosie O'Donnell." So my publicist who's with me negotiates with Rosie's publicist who's with her. Okay, so the two of them are out in the hall, and it's basically like they're hammering out the articles of the Treaty of Ghent. I don't even know what is being said or promised, but the Treaty of Ghent's a real thing, right? Where's my husband? He knows this stuff. Where is he? Where are you? Would he leave? Where? Wave. No, he's not. My husband who calls me 2 days ago and says, "We have a house guest." And I'm like, "What?" And he says, "Well, my dad, you know, the night of your reading that you need to like be like calm and get ready and prepare yourself. My dad is staying over because he's doing his colonoscopy prep." I said, "Most people just send flowers." Shit. But he's doing okay. He somehow, did you see what he has? He's procured a kosher cleanse kit. I didn't know it wasn't kosher to do colonoscopy prep, but evidently, like, the rabbi has blessed his enema. I don't know. I want to be the rabbi whose job that is. Baruch atah Adonai. Never mind. Okay, so anyhow, so Rosie O'Donnell is in the building, and we negotiate it, and my publicist finally says, "Okay, you can go in and meet her." So we walk down the hall, and there's Rosie with, like, her entourage of, like, her hair and her makeup people and the assistants and the assistants' assistants, and she looks at me, and she says, "Who are you?" And I couldn't remember. I didn't know. But I finally came back to me. I'm like, you know, I'm Jennifer Weiner, and I write novels, and, you know, what are they about? And I said, "Well, the first one was about this girl, and she's a reporter, and, you know, she's had this bad breakup, and then her mother comes out of the closet, and Rosie turns to my mom, Fran, and says, 'You?' And my mom says, 'Uh-huh.' And Rosie says, 'How old were you?' And my mom says, 54. And Rosie says, 'So wait a minute.' She's like, 'You're with men for all those years? You're having sex with men, and you're thinking, I don't know, this is okay, but there could be more?' And I said, 'Or less.'" And then my mother says, "The first time a woman's lips touched mine, it was magical." And then I threw up a little in my mouth. And I had to go. I had to leave. So I go back to my dressing room, which has a star on the door that says Jennifer Weiner. I'm taking pictures of it because I'm really cool that way. And, you know, like, I'm getting my Spanx on and everything. It takes, you know, a good 15 minutes. And then I go back to Rosie's dressing room, and they're still talking about sex. You know, and my mom is like, "I never knew it could be like that." I'm like, "Oh, God. TMI. And so then the producer comes to get Rosie, you know, like, "Miss O'Donnell, we're going to take you to the set now." And she's walking down the hall, and she yells over your shoulder. She says, "Send me your books." And then she thinks about it and yells, actually, I could buy them. And I'm like, yeah, you could. So somebody asked at the reading last night, like, how does your family feel about being included in all of these stories that you tell? And I said that, you know, there's different sort of literary views on this. Like, you know, there's sort of the Philip Roth idea that you're like writing for the ages and you're writing for posterity and who cares what Aunt Minnie thinks. And, you know, my whole idea is like, I got to go home for Passover. So like, I care deeply about what Aunt Minnie thinks. But so everybody in my life sort of gets to read what I'm writing ahead of time and sort of let me know, you know, are there problems, are there issues, whatever. And I said, the only holdout is my mother's life partner, Claire's sister, Carla. Okay. Carla dates amputees. Yes. She has dated 3 different guys missing an arm. Not even kidding. And when you go to visit the parents' house and you're like looking through the family albums of her with these different boyfriends, it's like watching the evolution of the prosthetic. It's like, you know, it's like in the 80s, there was the dude with the hook, right? And then in their 90s, it was the guy with like the mechanical arm that was like, and now, you know, like the last guy had like the super high tech, like, you know, it was great. But, you know, I had a lot of questions about this. Like, where do you meet amputees? Like, do you hang out outside of the prosthetic workshop and wait? And then you see a guy and you say, hey, handsome. Need a hand with that? I had questions. Like, why would you, like, what would it be like? I mean, I know that there are people who have types, you know, like blondes or redheads, but like amputees? Like, I just didn't get it. And so I had a couple glasses of wine one night when we were out at the local clam shack. And I'm like, Carla, what is up with this? And she's like, I'll tell you, but you can't ever use it. And I'm like, come on. Like, if God gives you some, like, sick fetish about guys missing an arm, like, don't you think God wants me to use it? Isn't that how it works? But she says, no, you can't use it. You have to swear. And she writes out a contract on the like paper tablecloth that I sign with a crayon and a Dora sticker. And then she's like, okay, I'm going to tell you. Are you ready? And I'm like, I'm ready. And she looks at me and she says, it's a sex thing. And I'm like, oh God, I can't even hear anymore. What? I'm like, are they doing things to you with the stump? I don't even want to know. I just don't. I mean, is it about vulnerability? I, and then I'm like, what about guys missing a leg? She's like, oh no, that's creepy. Go figure. I met Jeffrey Eugenides a couple months ago. He wrote Middlesex, which, have you guys read it? It's about a transgendered, well, it's a person who's being raised female but turns out to be male. Basically, a hermaphrodite. I think I'm probably botching all the acceptable terms. But anyhow, so I'm out to dinner with him, and he's like this lovely guy, and he's like really low-key and really self-effacing. But, you know, he's like, he won the like National Book Award. So, of course, like, I'm a nervous wreck. So I'm like having a couple glasses of wine to try to like make this okay. And finally, I work up the nerve to speak to him, and I'm like, you know, when my daughter was born, I just read your book, and I made the pediatrician look really close. And he gets this look of horror on his face. And he says, you're kidding, aren't you? And I'm like, oh no. I'm like, I don't want to be the mom who missed a penis. And then I'm like, I'm not the only one. And I'm like, I'm thinking like lots of people probably read this book and like took us a look down there to be sure. Like, right? But he was looking at me like I was such a freak, and it hurt. It hurt so much. It was difficult. So I'm on Cape Cod for the summer with like my mom and my daughters and my sister, and my whole extended family was up there for 4th of July. And I realized that I'm reaching the point in my life where I have a 2.5-year-old and she's learning every day new words and new skills and new things to master to get her through life. And my mother is forgetting all of these things at an identical rate. The other day we dropped off the 7-year-old at camp, and like, so I get out of the car and I like walk her to her tent and I sign her in and I put her sunscreen on and I go back to the car, and my mother is sitting there and she's furious. She says, why are you ignoring me? I said, what? She's like, I have been talking to you for 10 minutes and you haven't said anything. And I'm like, Ma, you're talking to the wrong minivan. There's no one in there. You know, it's like, I mean, I know everybody has that minivan, but like, I'm like, they didn't roll their windows down. Wasn't that a clue? Just like, no, not really. And then my sister calls before she comes and she's like, can I bring a friend? And I'm like, is it a boy? You know, like I'm 40 and she's 38 and this is how we talk to each other. I'm like, is it a boy? So she shows up with this guy, Garrett. Okay. And Garrett has a thumb ring and I don't judge. They come in at night and Garrett's all like chatty and funny and like lively. And then he goes, I go to bed at 10, which is late for me, and they go to bed whenever. And like the next morning, my sister's up making coffee and I'm like, where's Garrett? And she's like, oh, he's not feeling well. So like we go, you know, do our day and swim and bike and cook. And then, you know, around dinner time, Garrett sort of ambles upstairs and, you know, again, he's like perfectly pleasant and like helping with dinner and doing the dishes. And then the next morning we're all getting ready to go to the beach and we're all in the car. I'm like, where's Garrett? And she's like, oh, he's not coming. And I'm like, are you dating a vampire? Like a sparkly vampire? Like what is going on with Garrett? And she, you know, it's like, it's so hard when you have to like ask yourself the tough questions about like your sister's boyfriend, like vampire or IV drug user? Like which, I just don't know. I think the thumb ring means something, but I don't know what. So is anybody watching The Bachelorette? Or is, yes. Oh, thank God. Thank God. Okay. The Jake Vienna thing. Okay. Right. Okay. So like, for those of you who don't know, Jake was the bachelor last season and he picked Vienna, the trashy girl, instead of Tenley, the nice girl. I'm simplifying, but only very slightly. And, so like they go off to like, you know, hand in hand into the, you know, pink misted happiness. And then like 2 months later, they break up and like she's on one tabloid cover and he's on another tabloid cover. So of course, like the bachelor, never missing an instant to grab some ratings, has like the interview, like Jake and Vienna meet for the first time. So they're on TV and they're talking about what went wrong. And like, she's like, you know, my dog was in surgery and you weren't supportive. And he's like, I was on Dancing with the Stars and you weren't supportive. And they're going back and forth. And finally he says, well, you're just a fame whore. And she looks at him and is like, you're the fame whore. And I'm thinking, kids, you met on a reality TV show. I'm going to say you're both fame whores and let's just move along. Cause you know, and then I imagine like actual whores watching that and being like, dude, leave us out of this. You're both disgusting. But then, okay. So Jake, Allie was one of the bachelorettes in Jake's house and she was like, you know, he really liked her and she liked him, but then her job wanted her back and she had to choose. It was this big drama. She had to choose between her job and love and she chose her job. Which was awesome because Jake sort of came across as a creepy psycho in that interview. So like total good decision. But now she's the bachelorette and she's dating these guys. And it's like, okay, so she's dating Justin, who is a professional wrestler, right? Only Justin has a girlfriend in Canada. Do any of you guys know Avenue Q? Right? You know, where the gay puppet is singing about, you know, I wish you could meet my girlfriend who lives in Canada. And of course, he doesn't actually have a girlfriend, but he's just invented this fictitious character. Her name is Alberta. She lives in Vancouver. She cooks like my mother and sucks like a Hoover. But, so anyhow, but like, there is no girlfriend in Canada, but Justin has a girlfriend in Canada. Her name is Jessie. And they show her and she's sitting next to this other girl who was on the show whose name is also Jessie because they only have one name in Canada for girls. And, you know, and Jessie's telling Allie, she's like, we've been dating for 2 years. He says he loves me. We're getting married. And Allie is like, you can see like her heart break. And it's, and then she's like giving like the interview and she's all like teary and her mascara's running. And she's like, you know, I just don't think I believe in love anymore. And I'm like, you know what else I bet she doesn't believe in is professional wrestling. She's going to be like, that's all a lie. It's faking it. So anyhow, I don't have a book. Does anybody have a book that I can read from really quick?
You can all admire my face here. Hopefully something's coming out. I'll give it back. Thank you.
It was really stupid. You can tell it's early in book tour. Like, normally I remember this stuff. But this is Fly Away Home. This is my new book. Yay, lovely. Nobody... Mm-hmm. Unlike Best Friends Forever, nobody looks like they're picking their bathing suit out of their ass crack on the cover, so I'm really, really pleased about that. The art department was so offended. Like, somebody took a YouTube video of me at one of my readings doing the whole, like, you know, there's a wedgie on my cover, and, like, and there was. I mean, like, it was a total, it was a wedgie, but they took great offense. But I've just learned over the years that, like, anything I have to say about covers, I should just not say. Because, like, with Good in Bed, lo, these many years ago, my editor asked me, she's like, have you given any thought to the cover? And, of course, that was my first book. And so that's the one you, like, work on and dream about and fantasize about and imagine yourself sitting across from Oprah with. And so, of course, I had thought about the cover. And I'm like, okay, are you ready? I have this really good idea. Are you ready? Are you sitting? Are you ready? Are you ready? Wait for it. Wait for it. Here it comes. I think there should be a bed on the cover. Uh-huh. A bed. And I think the bed should be made on the front cover and then all, like, rumply on the back cover. And the guy, Pablo from the art department, I remember, was, like, backing away from me slowly with the Jeffrey Eugenides look of horror on his face, because I guess that wasn't such a good idea. He's like, we like to have people on the covers. That really works for us, dumbass. So, but yeah, you know, it's I love this cover, and this is my sort of attempt at ripped from the headlines books, because, like everyone I know, I was fascinated by all of the political scandals of, like, the last 18 months, and I think I found nothing more fascinating than the Elliot and Silda Spitzer press conference. Do you remember that? Where, like, okay, the governor of New York is standing up there admitting to paying $5,000 for an escort. And, of course, I am sitting there thinking, what is any woman doing that is worth that much money? Like, $5,000, I'd want her to do my taxes, too. You know, like, $5,000, like, what is she doing? Should I be doing it? Like, can I learn? I have a friend of a friend who's done a lot of traveling in the Middle East and talked about going to a bordello. And the way that this worked, it was like, it was six stories high. And as you ascended through the building, the women became more and more beautiful and skilled and expensive. And so he's telling me this story, and all I'm thinking is, like, what is the job audition like? And I could just imagine, like, showing up in my Spanx as I am and having, like, the madam look at me and say, like, you first floor woman! And I'd be like, really? I have a really nice personality. I'm lively. You know, like, and then, of course, I'm just like, well, like, do you ever get promoted? Like, can you move up in the house? Like, do you move down in the house? And then I'm like, are there handicap ramps? Like, you know, like, what if you want a sixth floor woman, but you can only get to the first floor? Like, do they bring one down? Like, how does this work? I don't know. But, you know, and, but like, with the Elliot Spitzer thing, like, you know, and there is his wife, and this woman is, like, Ivy League educated and, like, had been a lawyer, and she's standing there, and I'm like, why? Like, why are you up there? You didn't do anything wrong. You didn't abuse the taxpayers' trust and money. You didn't overpay for sex. Like, why are you there? And so I decided I wanted to write a book about a politician's wife, because I didn't understand why a woman would be there, why she would put herself through that. I didn't get any of it, and I wanted to. And so I decided to write this book, and it's about a politician's wife and her two daughters. And, of course, the problem that I ran into was reality. Because any kind of, like, over-the-top, ridiculous behavior I wanted my characters to engage in would immediately be trumped the very next day by John Edwards and Mark Sanford. You know, it's like, I'm hiking the Appalachian Trail. And the Appalachian Trail is like, leave me out of this shit. And then it's like, I wasn't hiking the Appalachian Trail. I was with my Argentinian soulmate. Which really hurt me, because, like, that was the moment I realized that, like, at 40, I will never be anybody's Argentinian mystery woman. And it hurt. I'm not Argentinian, and I'm not very mysterious. But then, you know, okay, so you've got the Mark Sanford, like, bag o' lies, and then you've got the John Edwards stuff, where it's like, you know, I'm like, I'm going to have my politician meeting women through the casual encounter section on Craigslist. Ha ha, isn't that nutty, right? And then John Edwards, it's like you pick up the paper and it's like, okay, he has impregnated his mistress slash videographer. He has stashed her in a safe house in California that Bunny Mellon's dollars are paying for. And he's convinced this other staffer, who I think is gay in love with him, to claim that he's the dad. And there's a sex tape. What is any novelist supposed to do? You know, and I just kept thinking about the sex tape and like the fact that he has a daughter in her 20s. And I'm just thinking, like, you know that somewhere this daughter is going to stumble across it and just be like, Dad, pants. You know, and then the Al Gore thing. I did not see that coming. That's what she said. But, right. You know, it's like, okay, first of all, anybody who books a 3-hour massage, something bad is going to happen. Like, you can't go to a salon and say, I'd like a 3-hour massage. Like, they're going to run out of things to rub. And then where does it leave you? But like with him, like, I just can't imagine him doing the stuff that she says that he did. I can imagine him being like, now we're going to talk about your carbon footprint. Like that I can see. But pants. So I'm gonna read very briefly from Fly Away Home, and then I'm gonna take questions because that's more fun. And please eat lots of cupcakes on your way out. Don't send me home with those and my father-in-law doing his colonoscopy prep. Those are not two great tastes that taste great together. Okay. So we're at breakfast, and Richard is the senator, and he has ordered his eggs, and Sylvie, his wife, is waiting with the plate for them. The first time Sylvie's mother, the Honorable Selma Surfer, had seen her daughter perform this maneuver, she'd stared with her mouth open and a dot of Crimson Kiss lipstick staining her incisor. Seriously? She'd asked. Sylvie tried to shush her. Selma, as always, had refused to be shushed. Seriously, Sylvie? This is what you do? You fetch his eggs? He's busy, Sylvie murmured, shifting the plate to her right hand and tucking her hair behind her ear with her left. I don't mind. She knew what her mother was thinking without the Honorable Selma having to say a word. Sylvie should mind, and Sylvie should be busy, too. Like her mother, Sylvie had gone to Barnard and Yale and was meant to have followed in Selma's footsteps straight up to the Supreme Court, or at the very least practiced law for more than 2 years. Selma and David's only child had been intended for better things than marriage, motherhood, committee work, and collecting her husband's breakfast. Oh, well, she thought, as the chef swirled melted butter in a pan. She was happy with her life, even if it didn't please her mother. She loved her husband. She respected what he'd accomplished. She felt good about the part she'd played in his career, and she knew it could be worse. In cities all over the world, women went hungry, were beaten or abused. Women watched their children suffer. Sylvie had seen them. It seemed churlish to complain about the occasional small indignity, about the hours she'd spent campaigning, face smoothed into a pleasant expression, mouth set in a smile, hair straightened into an inoffensive shoulder-length bob, wearing hose that squeezed her middle and pumps that pinched her toes, standing behind her husband, saying nothing. Normally it didn't bother her, but every so often discontent rose up inside, spurred by some unpleasant reminder of her unrealized potential. A few months ago, the forms for her 35th reunion at Barnard had arrived in her inbox. There had been a survey, a series of questions about life after college, and one of them was, tell us how you spend your time. If you're working, please describe your job. Before she could stop herself, Sylvie had typed, my job is to stay on a diet so I can fit into size 6 St. John knit suits and none of the bloggers say my ass is getting big. She'd erased the words immediately, replacing them with a paragraph about her volunteer work, the funds she raised for the homeless and the ballet, breast cancer research, and the library. She'd added a sentence about her daughters, Diana, who was a doctor, and Lizzie, vexing Lizzie, who'd given them such heartache, now several months sober, with her hair restored to its original blonde and all those horrible piercings practically closed. She'd added a final beat for how, for the last 14 years, she'd been lucky enough to travel the world in the company of her husband, Senator Richard Woodruff, D.N.Y. But sometimes, late at night, she thought that the truth was the first thing she'd written. Whatever ambition she'd possessed, whatever dream she'd once had, Sylvie Surfer Woodruff had grown up to be a 57-year-old professional dieter, a woman whose only real job, now that her daughters were gone, was staying 20 pounds thinner than she'd been in law school. So that is how it starts. Thank you. All right. So who wants to know something? Somebody must want to know something. Yes, in the yellow. Hello. Thank you.
Certainly. And how do you balance being a working mother with your career?
Balancing working mother with career. I mean, I have a lot of help. That is like the long and the short of it. Like, I could not do this unless I had help. I have a wonderful assistant. Where's Megan? Megan's in here somewhere. Megan is fabulous and like takes care of like the house and like is sort of me when I'm not there, in a purely G-rated fashion. And then I have a sitter from 11 to 7 every day. I'm covered. I'm like double covered. So basically, like, you know, you get up in the morning and you drag the grumpy 7-year-old out of bed and like tell her she has to wear underpants because she's not Britney. And like, I wasn't expecting to have that fight till later, you know, the like, no, you need to wear them. But like, you know, she doesn't like pink and she doesn't like sparkly and she doesn't like purple or hearts or patterns or like anything. So I found her boy shorts. But there's a little tiny bow on the boy shorts, and I had to cut it off of every single pair. And then she's like, they're scritchy. And I'm like, I don't even know what that means. But so anyhow, kids dressed, breakfast, big girl on the school bus. And then I either I have little gym on Tuesdays and music class on Thursdays. And Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I try to go to the gym, which has childcare. And I take Phoebe, the little one, with me. And then at 11, the sitter comes. So I hand off the baby, and I go take a shower if I've been to the gym and sort of get myself together. And the baby has lunch. And then she goes down for her nap, and I go to work. And I go to, there's a coffee shop in my neighborhood that has Cafe Fulia that has amazing baklava, but they have to cut me off after one piece. We have a deal. And they can't tell me the code for the internet until I've, like, written my pages for the day. It's good to have deals like that in place. So basically, like, from, like, 1 to 5 every day, 5, 5:30, depending, I write. And then I come home, and generally Lucy, my big girl, is home from, you know, school, or if she's got something going on after. And then, you know, we watch a little TV, we have dinner, we do stories, we do baths, we do bed. And then I'm like so brain dead that all I can do is mock The Bachelor on Twitter. You know, but the only way I know for moms to do it is get help, like to get somebody for a couple hours a day, a couple days a week. You know, even if it's like swapping babysitting with a friend, like I'll take your kids for this day, you take my kids for that day. Because like I had this fantasy, like I wrote my first two books before I had children. And then I'm like, oh, but you know, the hours are so flexible and I'll just write while she naps. Did not happen. You know, and it's just, and I find also that leaving my house is important because like when you're in a coffee shop, there's no laundry to fold. There's no, like, you can't like return calls or scrub anything. Not that I would, but, you know, it's like, it's a place that someone else has to maintain. And I think that's an important, for me, like it's psychologically valuable to sort of like pack up the laptop and the keys and the phone and go be some other place to get my work done. So that is how I do it. You're welcome. That's probably more than you wanted to know. She's like, you lost me at underpants. Yes.
I'm curious to know what authors you like to read.
Oh, what authors I like to read. Okay. I love Susan Isaacs. She's one of my favorites. She has a new book out now called As Husbands Go that's terrific. It's really like dark and funny and great, just totally engrossing and great for the beach, and I love her. This woman named Sarah Pekkanen, who I did a contest for earlier this spring, wrote a book called The Opposite of Me, which was a sister book that I really liked very much. I just picked up the new Maile Malloy, who's a short story writer, and her new book is called Both Ways is the Only Way I Want It, which is a great title. Love that. I love Stephen King. I love Anne Tyler. I just reread The Accidental Tourist, which is one of my all-time favorite books. But generally, if you go onto my blog, which is jenniferweiner.blogspot.com, because I'm super creative, or like Twitter or Facebook, I try to talk about what I'm reading if I'm loving it. And if I don't like it, I try not to say anything at all. It's hard sometimes. I just read this memoir of this... It was one of these books of like, sort of like, I am a rich and beautiful woman, but yet my life feels empty. So of course I flipped to the author photo and I'm like, you need to eat a sandwich. Like that's, it's not like soul deadening ennui. You're just hungry. Like that's what's going on there. But you know, so she solved, you know, she starts doing all of this yoga. like, she lives in a farm in Litchfield, but she has to go do all of this yoga and go do yoga retreats. And I'm like, if you have enough money to do, like, yoga retreats every weekend, like, your life just can't be that bad. But then she goes to a silent yoga retreat, and I'm, like, so hopeful that's the end of the book. Can't talk anymore, but no. Alas. But it was like, it was so terrible because it was like this, the author was Jewish, but like every five pages she would feel compelled to point out that she doesn't look Jewish like the rest of her family. Like she didn't have like the frizzy hair and the big nose and the big butt. And I was just like, I actually felt parts of me getting bigger while I read. And it was very disconcerting. So I can't recommend that book, but I won't tell you what it is. So if you're safe. Somebody over on this side, I'm like neglecting this. Is there somebody back there? Is that I don't know. You. Yes, you. I don't have my glasses on. You guys are all blurry. It's nice. Like a Monet.
On your website, you talk about how important reporting was mm-hmm. to becoming a writer. So I was wondering, what were some of the more interesting things you came across in your newspaper days? And if any of those made it into your book?
My favorite newspaper story of all time. This is the story that got me my second job. I was working at a small daily paper in central Pennsylvania in State College, the Center Daily Times, and I was, you know, like, you're a general assignment reporter at a small paper, so you cover everything. And my first summer, I was covering a bear. Okay? Because there was this bear that would, like, there's lots of farms out in central Pennsylvania. Like, it's basically, like, there's Penn State and the football fields. And then you like drive like 2-3 miles and it's Deliverance. Like, you know, you hear the banjos, right? So, there was this bear that was like going to people's farms and it would like eat corn and then like roll around in the cornfields and like make a big mess and scare people. So I'm like writing these funny stories about the bear and I become friends as you do with the game wardens. You know, I'm like talking to them like, hey, you caught that bear yet? You know, what's going on with the bear? And one day I'm all dressed up to go cover my school board meeting and they're like, hey, we caught the bear. And I'm like, good for you. And they're like, do you want to come see? And I'm like, no. I'm Jewish. Like, we don't do that. And, you know, but the guy was like, no, come on, like, come see the bear. So I'm like, okay, fine. So I like drive out, you know, and I'm all like, you know, and so the bear was, its leg was in a trap. Like, I know. And so it's so funny when I'm on the East Coast and I tell the story, I'm like, and the bear's leg was in a trap. And everybody goes, aw. And then I go to Texas and I'm like, and the bear's leg was in a trap. And they go, yee-haw! It's hilarious. Little regional differences for you. It's an okay trap though. Like they're going to free the bear eventually. And so the game warden says, now watch this. And he takes a tranquilizer gun and he shoots the bear in the butt. And the bear stands there and it's like wavering and wavering and wavering. And you know, in its head, it's like walking up to Jeffrey Eugenides and saying, I don't want to miss a penis. And then it falls over on its face. So, and this big cloud of fleas like burst into the air. It was really, bears smell awful. They smell like dying dogs. It was just really gross. So the ranger goes over and the first thing he does is pulls out a tooth to like see, they're going to take that back to the crime lab, I guess, and see how old the bear is. And then he tags it. He puts this little tag in the bear's ear. And, you know, then he's like, okay, you know, now we got to get it into my truck. And I'm like, we? And he's like, just give me a hand. And so, like, I'm in my heels and a skirt. I'm dragging a passed out bear into the back of this guy's SUV, right? And so we get it in the back, and it's, like, draped over the seats. I'm like, is this safe? He's like, I think so. So, you know, we drive to, like, a ridge, like, 10 miles away, and we, like, roll the bear out of the car and take off. So I'm driving back to State College, and I'm thinking many things. And one of them is that, like, I am pretty sure this is not what I went to Princeton to do. And the other thing is, like, I really have to change my clothes now before I go to this board meeting. And then I'm thinking about this poor bear that's going to wake up. It's not going to know where the hell it is or how the hell it got there. It's going to be missing a tooth and have a new piercing. Okay? This is, like, the worst fraternity initiation ever. Right? So I go back and I write this story, like this funny story about the bear, and the copy desk puts the headline on it, Caught Bear Learns Lesson, comma, for now. Goddamn copy desk. They were always doing that to me. Like, I would write these funny stories and they would give these like bone dry headlines, you know, like science fair instructs, comma, delights. Like, even if it wasn't about a science fair, I would get that headline. So the bear was fun. I covered the Pillsbury Bake Off, which was awesome. The thing about the Bake Off is, like, there's 50 finalists in the Bake Off, and the year I went, it was held in Dallas in, like, this auditorium, and they had to bake their winning recipes three times, once for the judges, once for the photographers, and once for the press. I was the press, okay? And I think, like, out of the 50 finalists, 42 of them made desserts. So I decide that it is important for the journalistic integrity of the story that I taste everything. So after about like the 20th bite of dessert, like I am on such a sugar high. It's like I've dropped acid, okay? Like I'm seeing, I'm tasting colors and I'm seeing sounds. And then at the bake-off, they have somebody dressed as the Pillsbury Doughboy going around and posing with the contestants. So I decide that what I have to do, again, for the journalistic integrity of the story, is poke the doughboy to see if he goes, hee-hee, right? So I'm, like, following the doughboy around the auditorium, and I'm, like, sneaking, and I'm, like, getting behind him, and I'm so close, and I'm not quite there. So I take my pen, and I had just meant to, like, give a gentle little poke, but the pen just sank into the doughboy's side, and then I heard the sound that you never want to hear. Shit! So I run, I do, and I'm out in the like, you know, I'm out of the auditorium. I'm like, okay, it's cool. Nobody saw me. It's all good. And then I remember that the pen says Jennifer Weiner, Philadelphia Inquirer. I never got caught, but I also didn't get asked back, so. But that, you know, that was a highlight, was definitely covering the Bake Off. You know, I loved being a reporter, and I mean, it's hard now because I think it's the best training you can get for being a novelist is being a journalist and sort of being out in the world, seeing different situations, paying attention to the way people talk and the way they interact and sort of how they are. But I just wouldn't tell anybody to go get a job at a paper these days. I think that's just not good advice anymore. You know, and I do think that journalism is going to be okay, but I think it's going to take a while to sort of sort out, like, the whole online thing and the idea that, like, reporting is worth money. Even though we've all gotten used to reading anything we want to for free, you know, that somebody's going to have to pay for the work of, like, being a watchdog, you know? But, yes, I loved it. Bears and baked goods. Yes.
Hi.
Hello.
So I think you do a really great job on Twitter and with kind of social media and marketing for yourself and for your book. How important do you think it is for authors to be doing this for themselves?
Ah, that's the Twitter. And did you see I got in a Twitter fight today? I got in a Twitter fight. Some blogger, and I think at this point my publisher will send a free book to anybody who says they have a blog. And so this woman had a problem with the characters having unprotected sex in my book, as if they were real people who were going to contract real diseases. Like, she was treating this, like, really, really humorlessly. And she kept, like adding me, like, did a little at sign, so I would see every time she wrote about it how much she hated the book. And so I was finally like, you know, why do you keep doing this? And she's like, oh, you can't handle a little criticism. And I'm like, well, no, but I just think it's kind of like rude for you to keep doing this. And then, you know, I trying to like be funny about it, I got this great review in People Magazine. So I'm like, you know, People Magazine says Fly Away Home is this, you know, like excellent summer read. And this crazy lady, I didn't say crazy lady, I said her name, says too much unprotected sex. And then she writes, she's like, oh, People Magazine, like anybody gets their book advice from that. I'm like, everybody does. Like, that's, you know, and she's like, oh, and like, you want to be a summer read. That's only 2 months. And I'm like, so I'm only going to be on the bestseller list for 2 months. That's really quite okay. But so anyhow, and then I blocked the bitch. So, but yeah. Thank you. But, I do think that it's important for authors to be doing all of the social media that they can, and I think that any publisher would tell an author that you have to do it. Like, it's not optional anymore. Like, when I got started, lo these many years ago, I bought the rights, you know, I bought the domain name to jenniferweiner.com, and I launched a blog. And, like, nobody really knew what blogs were back then. They're like, you want to have a blob? And I'm like, no, it's a blog. And they're like, yeah, go on with your bad self. So, but nowadays, it's like, publishing is struggling, you know, the same way all of media is, to sort of deal with ebooks and deal with Kindles and what does it mean, and marketing budgets and publicity budgets have been slashed, and the deal is they expect you, the author, to do a lot of the work that used to be a publicist's job. And part of that means being on Facebook, being on Twitter, having a blog, putting yourself out there online. And I really like it. I mean, to me, it feels like being part of this like funny, freewheeling conversation where you can like post pictures and talk about things and link to articles and just, I mean, I love, you know, I follow some celebrities on Twitter. I follow like a lot of other authors and see what they're talking about and being on book tour and how that's going. And I love it. A lot of writers don't. A lot of writers feel that their job is to write books and it's somebody else's job to sell them. And unfortunately, that's not an attitude you get to have anymore in publishing. And so the advice I give to writers, or really like anybody who wants to use social media, is like find something that you are passionate about, that you're interested in, that you care about, and Twitter and Facebook about that, because that will be authentic. And even if it's like birding, or like something weird, even if it's The Bachelorette, you know, like people are attracted to authenticity and somebody who's got an opinion and is out there sort of being funny or being forthright or being honest or whatever it is. And, you know, I think that that's what works. I think what doesn't work is the authors who are only on there to sell, you know, who are only on there to say, my new book is out, I got this great review, here's somebody who said something nice about it. Like, you can't do it that way, because I think that readers are very, very savvy about social media, and they know when somebody's there to talk versus when somebody's there to sell them stuff. So, but again, you know, the world is changing, and I'm hoping to do my best to keep up and change with it, but don't change too much. Yes.
Art, first of all, you're fabulous.
Oh, thank you. You hear that?
Are any of your other books going to be turned into films? And if so, are you interested or involved in writing any of the screenplays for that?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, all the books have been optioned. And what I've learned that means is you take the money and you cash the check really quickly and then just do your best to forget about it, because it's such a long shot to have, I mean, within her shoes, like, I was so lucky. And I thought I knew how lucky I was at the time, but now that I've seen, like, books of mine get optioned, not get made, friends' books get optioned, not get made, like, that was a miracle that happened. And so you know, I'm delighted when they get optioned. I'm thrilled when people think, like, this is a great story, we'd love to do it on screen. Like, that's all very flattering. But I try not to get too invested, because, like, my job's to write the books and to sort of let go of what happens with them in the world. And in terms of writing the screenplays, I'm friends with Carrie Rickey, who's one of the film critics at The Inquirer. And I remember when In Her Shoes was optioned, she told me, she's like, don't try to adapt it. She said, a novelist trying to adapt her own material is like a mother trying to circumcise her own son. She said, let someone else cut. And I said, okay. Because really, like, that's the job of a screenwriter adapting a novel, is cutting and condensing and sort of like taking something 300 pages long and turning it into something that's 90 pages long. And then I thought it would be like eating the same meal for dinner every night. Like, when you write a book, like, I'm living with those characters for a year, and like, I'm hearing them, I'm thinking about them, they're with me all the time. And it's sort of nice to move to the next thing. So I don't know. I mean, I guess never say never, you know, with any stuff out there in Hollywood. Like, there's always chances. But, you know, for now, like, if anything happens, it'll be on my Twitter and Facebook and blog. So there were other questions over this way. Yes, in the cardigan.
Have you considered writing another murder mystery after Goodnight Nobody?
Oh, another murder mystery. It's so funny, because I actually, the book that I'm working on now, it's not... It's not a murder mystery, but there are elements of mystery in it. And one of my characters just decided she needs to go to a private investigator to have somebody checked out, her new stepmother, who she doesn't believe is what she says she is. And so she goes, she calls her father's lawyer and says, like, what investigator do you use? And her father sends her to Kate Klein from Goodnight Nobody. So we get to see Kate and Janie again, which I'm thrilled about. But I loved writing that book. I really, really liked it. It was very, very challenging, and I would like to do another one. The book I'm working on now, though, it's not, it, like I said, it's a mystery, and it's about surrogate mothers, which I'm so fascinated by, that sort of intersection of sort of class and money and the way that, that sort of rich women are paying for other women's bodies in this sort of like weird way. And I'm just really, really interested in that whole, there was an, a big article in the Sunday, in the New York Times Sunday magazine about a very wealthy woman who was infertile and hired a gestational surrogate. And the woman lived in Pennsylvania and was photographed like barefoot and pregnant, literally in sort of this like not very glamorous home. And then the woman who was hired her was like at the Hamptons with her uniformed nanny. It was very, very strange. But so, but someday maybe. Yes. Yes.
I know that a lot of, well, that's loud. A lot of what you write is from what you know in your own life. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what you written about Cannie is about Princeton. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering about your own experiences there and if they kind of got better after what Cannie seems to go through there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my Princeton experience wasn't that bad. Like, I think a lot of things in books that, like, I'll take something from my own life and, like, exaggerate it for, like, comic effect or poignancy or whatever. But, you know, I think a lot of people at places like Princeton go through their 4 years feeling like they're the admissions committee's mistake. And at any moment, somebody is going to be like, yeah, you know, it was somebody else with your name who was supposed to be here. So could you, like, leave and go to community college? Thanks, bye. You know, but I took, the further away I get from Princeton and the further I go as a novelist, the more amazing I realize what a gift I was given to be able to be like 18, 19, 20 years old and sitting in a room with eight other people and Toni Morrison or Joyce Carol Oates or John McPhee or Sandy McClatchy or Ann Lauterbach or the poets that I studied with. I mean, like, it was amazing. I got an amazing education as a reader and a writer. And even if I had very few dates, my 4 years of college, and felt like I had wandered into an Abercrombie and Fitch catalog much of the time, you know, I mean, it was hard feeling, you know, like I wasn't one of the beautiful people or like I wasn't one of the smartest people anymore. But I think everybody felt that way in retrospect. I mean, I'm going to try to go to my reunion next year. It'll be my 20th reunion, and I'm really, really interested to talk to people who maybe I was too afraid to talk to before and sort of ask them what it was like for them to be there. But, you know, like for years I was just like, I made such a mistake going there. It wasn't the right place for me. But now looking back, like I think it was, like just academically, just in terms of getting to study with those people. And I just wonder, like, you know, at that age, if I, you know, if like I was, would have been happy anywhere. So it's all good with Princeton. I read this great book called Admission. Have any of you guys read that? It was so good. I loved it. But it's this admissions officer at Princeton who like is traveling the Northeast, and she's talking to students who want to go there and dealing with alums who want their kids to get in. And there's a scene where she's flagged an application because the parents are alums and are big donors. And so that's going in a special pile. And I just wanted to email her and be like, how much money do you have to like, I want to be in that pile. I want my kid in that pile. Like, what's that going to cost me? You know, but no, it's all good. It's all good with Princeton. That's a good question. I don't think anybody over there behind my husband.
That's the hubby. Going back to what you were saying about Facebook and Twitter, I've been to other authors' readings, and they're not as personable as you come off to be.
Oh, well, thank you. That's because I scared them all, probably.
Well, and that also, from what I'm noticing today, it's how you write. It is your voice.
Yeah.
So do you think that being good at Facebook and Twittering is because of your personality?
Yeah. No, it doesn't hurt. Like, you definitely have to, like, you have to be comfortable with it. And you have to be comfortable, like, cracking jokes or being pithy or just, like, it's a medium you have to master like anything else. Like learning how to tweet. I mean, I remember in my poetry classes, like you couldn't just go off and write whatever you wanted. It would be like, okay, we're doing sonnets this week. We're doing villanelles this week. You know, whatever the structure was, you had to learn it. And I think that Twitter, you have to learn. But yeah, I mean, like I said, I like it and I'm comfortable doing it. And I do think that makes a big difference. And I have writer friends who just struggle with it, or they don't do it at all because like to them, it doesn't feel good. And, you know, I do it because it feels good. So, but yeah, I mean, you know, but it's like, you know, I think that different writers have different advantages in different ways. You know, like I'm lucky insofar as like my personality lends itself well to social media. But then like if I had a penis, it would lend myself well to being reviewed by better places. I don't know. I did this interview yesterday with this guy who's interviewed me for basically every book, and he's like, you got to get over this thing with the New York Times. And I'm like, but I can't. I'm like, did you see they reviewed the David Nichols book, and it was a romance, and if I wrote that, they'd just ignore it. And he's like, yeah, but get over it. So I'm trying. In the front. Hello. Who's gonna get her? You're being approached from both sides. It's like Thunderdome. Hi.
It's so nice to be here. Last year, my friend and I came, and we were kicked out.
Oh!
So we were very, very
I think
sad.
The rain helped us all.
So we're very happy to be here.
Thanks.
And it's just so nice that you are who you are.
Thank you.
Everybody in here loves you so much.
Thank you.
I have an extremely non-intellectual question for you.
Please. Please.
But I have to ask.
Yes.
How do you think The Bachelorette is going to end?
Oh! Well, how do I think it's going to end? See, I read the spoilers. I read Reality Steve. But
I heard about Frank.
Yeah, okay. Frank has a girlfriend and is possibly gay, too. It could be both. Chris, I like him, and he's really sweet, but I think he's really, like, heartbroken. And I would like to see him be the next Bachelor, but I don't know if he's got, like, enough of a spark to carry a show on his own. I think she likes Roberto. I like Roberto too. Roberto has that cleft in the chin, and I want to dip things in there. Yeah. I want to fill it with balsamic vinegar and dip in strawberries. But I'm glad she got rid of the mold guy. Do you remember the mold guy? The guy who's like, I suffered from a mysterious illness. And I'm like, oh my God, what's it going to be? I'm like hanging on his every word. And he's like, I was racked with agony and I couldn't get out of bed. And I lost my baseball scholarship. And finally they figured out I was living in a house full of mold. And I was like, really? And they cut to Allie and she's like, he's so brave. And I'm like, come on. Like, he had mold, not zombies. Like, but yeah, I think Roberto. I think she's going to pick Roberto, and then I think I don't know. I say Roberto, though. I don't know if they're going to get married, but nobody gets married except Trista. Except Trista got married. She's their one success. I know, they're hanging on. She can't ever get divorced. They'd, like, murder her. Yes, in the blue. Or is it black? I don't even know.
Thank you. I've always enjoyed all your books.
Thank you.
But I also saw you in Rock Bottom Remainder.
Yes.
Now, I want to know, are you going to tour with them again?
They haven't asked. I had such
fun?
A good time. I loved it. I think that like many writers have like the secret rock star fantasy because like what you do is like you schlump around in coffee shops and you know, it's like this very private thing. And so like, but who wouldn't want to get out there and like sing backup? Like everybody does, I think, maybe secretly. But no, the sad thing is, like, I can carry a tune on my own, but I really, like, I'm not, like, I'm going to use a technical musical term here. I'm not that good. So, I auditioned for American Idol, like, the American Idol experience at Disney World, because my husband was like, you have to try this. It'll really be fun. And so I go, and I make it through the first round, and then I got to sing for the judges, and they're like, no, you know, the voice isn't quite there. And they're like, but you have a really great personality. Like, have you ever thought of doing something in the entertainment industry? I'm like, no, I'm just a housewife. Somebody else, you, yes, in the hall, in the cute halter.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm a really big fan of yours, and
You're not that big.
What?
You're a very small fan of mine.
I am a very small fan, that is true.
Let's be honest about it.
That is true.
Eat some more cupcakes.
I did. They were delicious.
Yes.
I have a big question for you as far as a point of view of as an author. Mm-hmm. I'm a Kindle reader and mm-hmm. e-books. What is the feeling in the community about that?
That is a really great question because it's so interesting today because I just got my first day sales figures, right? And they're like, the good news is, like, at Barnes & Noble, my sales were up 15% from Best Friends Forever. I'm like, yeah, that's fantastic. And they're like, but you sold 733 fewer hardcovers, but 1,000 people bought it for the Nook. And I'm like, well, that's okay, right? Like, a book is a book, and as long as they're buying it. And they're like, the New York Times doesn't count ebooks for the bestseller list. Really? Yeah, so... right. Yeah, I think they're going to start doing a separate Kindle list, maybe. But right now, like, those sales don't count. And so, like, I never want to tell anybody how to buy a book. Like, I've got an e-reader, and I buy a ton of books there. But now I feel like I should be, like, saying, like, please buy a hardcover so the New York Times will know you've got it. And it's like, so that's, I mean... my personal feeling is, like, if somebody's reading my book, I do not care if they've got a hardcover, if they've got a paperback, if they took it out of the library, if they bought it at a tag sale, if somebody gave it to them, if they found it in a summer house. Like, I am just happy to be read, and I'm really, really not at all particular. The publishing industry is, like, has its panties in such a twist over this because it's the idea of, like, what is a book worth? And for a long time, they've been trying to say a book is worth $27 for the first 9 months it's on sale, at which point it's worth either $14.99 or $7.99, depending on whether we release it as a trade paperback or mass market. And Amazon has said a book is worth $10. No matter when it's released, you know, no matter if it's been out for a day or 10 years, a book is worth $10. And publishing has had to deal with that. And it's just... I read today that Janet Ivanovich is going to change publishers. And this is like, I'm trying to think of like what, it's sort of a LeBron thing in publishing. Is that right? Kinda? It's like the biggest player leaving the hometown team and going to seek more money because they wouldn't, she asked for the advance that she wanted and they're like, we're not going to give you that much money. And it's, you know, it has to do with ebooks, where like she's being read as much as she ever was, but maybe not in hardcover anymore. And publishers don't know what to do. So it's going to be very interesting to see it play out. But if you're asking me personally, just read my books. I don't care how. Yes.
What inspired Serpent Girls? I really enjoyed that book. Mm-hmm.
What inspired Certain Girls, which was the sequel to Good in Bed? I mean, I always knew I wanted to pick up Cannie's story again. Cannie's the heroine of Good in Bed, who sort of like gets the guy and the happy ending. And I always knew I wanted to sort of check in with her, but I didn't want to do, 6 weeks later. I wanted to sort of let her live her life for a while. And I guess a lot of it was sort of like worrying about things ahead of time. Like, I have daughters and I think a lot about like what my own adolescence was like and what, you know, how I can guide them and maybe make it better or make it easier. Like I was this sort of like weird, nerdy, bookish, like, and it was hard. Like I went to this, I grew up in this like very sort of fancy suburb of Connecticut where again, it was like the Abercrombie and Fitch thing. And it was like, I was like acutely aware of not fitting in. And it took me like till junior year of high school before I had like had a group of friends. And I think a lot about my daughters and like, what are they going to be like? What's it going to be like for them? So I wanted to write a book about mothers and daughters and bat mitzvahs. You know, it was sort of my way of like getting all the panic, like front loading it somehow. So that was where Certain Girls came from. Yeah. What, a couple more questions do we think? How are we doing? What time is it? 8:30? Okay. Two more questions and then I'm going to go up and sign all your books. Yes. Do I have a favorite and why of all my books? I think asking a mom to pick asking an author to pick a favorite is like asking a mom to pick her favorite kid. Like you can do it in your heart, but not in public. Oh God, did I just say that? I love both of my daughters. They're both like fantastic, but they're very, very different. Like my oldest, our oldest girl was like, a little smarty. Like, she was like an early talker and she very opinionated and long sentences. And then Phoebe, like a classic second child, was perhaps not as advanced in certain aspects. And I remember when she just learned how to walk, and both of them were really late walkers, and she needed both of her arms out for balance. So she was standing in the hall eating a banana, and then she saw something that she wanted. So I'm watching her try to figure out, how am I going to eat my banana and get to the thing that I want? And what she did was she takes the banana, shoves the whole thing in her mouth, and starts gagging as she's like walking toward this thing she wants. And I remember looking at my husband and being like, oh, we got to find her a safety school. what was the question? They're all special to me in different ways. Like, you know, Good in Bed is always going to be special because it was like my first one. Like, that's the one that I wrote. I didn't have a publisher. I didn't have an agent. I didn't have an editor. Like, I didn't have readers. I just had this manuscript. And like, that was, you know, the whole experience of like finding my agent and getting a publishing deal. And like that year of, you know, like every step along the way, like seeing the cover of the book and getting blurbs for the book and like hearing about the excitement about the book and getting reviews and like all of that was magical. You know, and In Her Shoes will always be special because of the movie. Little Earthquakes because it's about being a new mom and it'll always remind me of my daughter. Goodnight Nobody was the most challenging book that I've written. And so that one, I feel good about that one because of the work that went into it. And then The Guy Not Taken, which is the short story collection, which sort of like spans 20 years of my life. So, you know, like the first short story I ever published is in that book. So that's special. You know, and then Certain Girls, going back to visit those first characters was great. And then Best Friends Forever because it looks like a douche ad. And, you know, but Best Friends Forever was my first number one bestseller. And like getting that call was like amazing, you know, like having your editor and your publisher on the phone. They're like, you're number one. And like, you know, they're screaming and I'm screaming and everybody's screaming. And then I'm like, suck it, James Patterson. And ah, yes. Those were the days. No, so they're all special. They all. All right. So one more question. Yes. In the stripey shirt with the sparkly stuff. I love it from Target. That's great.
Thank you for the cupcakes, first of all.
You're welcome.
I heard what you said about the class issues with surrogates. Did mm-hmm. you ever consider writing about nannies or domestic help?
Ah, nannies.
I am a nanny.
Uh-huh. Yeah. There was an article in the Times today about nanny lit.
All the nanny books, that's why.
Right. You know, yes. Like, I'm fascinated by that. And I think that someday I will. There will be nannies in my books. You know, I have a working title if I ever write a nonfiction collection called My Nanny the Anarchist. Because my nanny is like, she's at the Rainbow Gathering right now. I think she's naked. So, yeah, you know, but it's like, I definitely, like, that's a fascinating dynamic, and it's really, like, rich for some exploration. So, like, stay tuned, and maybe someday. Thank you all. This was so fantastic. And I'm going to get my stuff, and I'll see you upstairs to sign the books. Take cupcakes, please. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.